of alienating Greg Myers, who's still the most important player here because of the mole. If Myers gets mad and disappears, we lose a source that cannot be replaced. A great source who might possibly one day break the case. So we wait. We serve the complaint, and McDover will lawyer up, as you say, but she will not know what we know. She and DuBose will assume that we believe poor Hugo was killed by a drunk driver and I got hit in the crossfire. They'll assume we know nothing about her fondness for private jets, expensive travel, trips to New York, Singapore, Barbados, you name it. They will not have a clue that we suspect Phyllis Turbin even exists. All we have is this one rather lame little complaint signed by a guy they've never heard of and can't find. So why do we bother with it? Michael asked. She was definitely back, her mind clicking right along. Post-concussion, post-swelling, there obviously was no damage. As always, she raked in the facts quicker than anyone and looked around corners for the big picture. Two reasons, and both of equal importance, she said. First, to keep Myers happy and busy digging. If we break this case, Michael, it will likely come down to the dirt provided by the mole, who knows a lot and has access to our judge. Second, we need to watch McDover's reaction to the complaint. Myers is probably right. She has no idea of what's coming. For the past 11 years, she and DuBose have had their way bulldozing the county, skimming cash from the casino, bribing anyone who raised an eyebrow, breaking legs, or worse. The money has been too easy, and it's probably deadened their senses. Think of it, Michael. The cash has been flowing for 11 years, and no one with authority has ever come snooping around. We show up with the complaint, and it rocks their world. Geismar stopped pacing and stared at a funky creation with four mismatched legs.
A chair? He asked.
Indeed, a Philippe Stark knockoff.
He live around here?
No, he does not. It works. Have a seat. Slowly, Michael settled into the chair and seemed surprised when it did not collapse. He gazed out the window and saw the Capitol in the distance.
Nice view.
That's my plan, she said. Do you have a different one?
No, not now.
Chapter 20. By Wednesday, Lacey was bored and contemplating a return to work. Her face looked much better, but she was still reluctant to be seen by her colleagues. Anne shopped and ran errands and did whatever Lacey wanted, but she was getting bored too. She drove Lacey to the grocery store and to a doctor's appointment. She drove her to the office of an insurance adjuster who handed over a check for the Prius. A total loss. Anne was a terrible driver and poked along regardless of the traffic. Lacey was numb with fear of moving vehicles, and her mother's dangerous driving didn't help matters. Lacey was sleeping well and without pain medication. Her physical therapy was progressing nicely and her appetite was returning. So it was no surprise when Anne announced over Wednesday dinner that she needed to go home. Very diplomatically, Lacey encouraged this. She appreciated her mother's care and concern, but she was clearly on the mend and tired of the babysitting. She wanted her space all to herself. More important, she'd met someone, a physical therapist who'd dropped by late Tuesday for a quick session, one carefully observed by Anne. His name was Rafe, and he was in his mid-twenties, a good 10 years younger, which didn't bother Lacey at all. There was a spark or two as he worked on her knee, and perhaps another as he said goodbye. He did not seem the least bit bothered by her cuts and bruises. She emailed him a short, "Hey, howdy," Wednesday night, and he responded within an hour. Back and forth a few times, and it was established that neither was in a relationship and both were interested in a drink. At last, Lacey thought, maybe something good might come from this catastrophe. In bed, flipping through a magazine, Lacey was startled by an email from Verna. It read, "Lacey, sorry not to have written or called sooner. I hope you're doing fine and recuperating. I'm so relieved your injuries were not as bad as they could have been. Me, I'm hanging on by a thread. Actually, I am completely overwhelmed with anything and everything. The kids are a mess and refuse to go to school. Pippin cries even more. At times they're all crying and I want to give up. But I refuse to break down in front of them. They need someone to be strong, so I just go hide in the shower and bawl my eyes out. I can barely survive each day and I hate the thought of tomorrow. Tomorrow without Hugo. Next week, next month, next year without Hugo. I cannot comprehend the future. The present is a nightmare. The past seems so long ago and so happy that it makes me sick. My mother is here along with my sister, so I'm getting plenty of help with the kids. But nothing is real. Everything seems artificial. They can't stay, so they'll leave soon, and I'll be here with four kids and no husband. I'd like to see you, but not now. I need some time. When I think of you, I think of Hugo and the way he died. Sorry. Please, just give me some time. Don't answer right now. Verna." Lacey read it twice and went back to her magazine. She would think about Verna tomorrow. Anne finally got away late Thursday morning, several hours after Lacey had hoped. Wonderfully alone for the first time in 10 days, she fell onto the sofa with Frankie and enjoyed the stillness. She closed her eyes and heard nothing, and it was lovely. Then she thought of Verna, and of all the horrible sounds echoing through the Hatch home. Crying kids and ringing phones and kinfolk shuffling in and out. She felt guilty for the contrast. She closed her eyes and was about to catch a wink when Frankie growled softly. There was a man standing at her door. Lacey went to the front window for a closer look. The door was locked. She felt safe. One quick push of a button on the security panel and all manner of alarms would erupt. The man was vaguely familiar. Deep tan, lots of long gray hair. "Mr. Greg Myers," she decided. "On dry land." She spoke through the intercom. "Hello?" His voice was familiar. "Looking for Lacey Stoltz," he said.
"And who are you?"
"Last name is Myers." She opened the door with a grin and said hello. As he stepped inside, she scanned the parking lot and noticed nothing unusual. "Where's the Panama hat and gaudy shirt?" she asked.
"I saved that for the boat." "What happened to all that beautiful hair?"
She pointed to the ugly scar on her head. 24 stitches, and still pretty sore."
"You look great, Lacey. I was so afraid you were badly injured. The newspapers have not said much about your condition, only that you had a head injury."
"Have a seat. I assume you want a beer."
"No, I'm driving. Just some water."
She pulled two bottles of fizzy water out of the fridge, and they sat at a small table in the breakfast nook. "So you've kept up through the papers?" she asked.
"Yes, an old habit, I suppose. Since I live on a boat, I need some contact with reality."
"I haven't looked at a newspaper since the wreck."
You haven't missed much. As for you and Hugo, they've already moved on.
I'm assuming I was easy to find here.
Quite. You're not trying to hide, are you?
No. I'm not living like that, Greg. I'm not afraid.
Must be nice. Look, Lacey, I've just driven 5 hours from Palm Harbor. I want to know what happened. You gotta tell me. It wasn't an accident, was it?
No, it wasn't.
Okay, I'm listening.
We'll talk, but first a question. Do you still use the same phones you were using a month ago?
He thought for a second and said, one of them.
And where is it right now?
On the boat. Palm Harbor.
Is Carlita on the boat?
Yes. Why?
Can you call Carlita right now, tell her to get the phone and toss it overboard? Now. You have no choice.
Sure.
Myers whipped out a burner and did as instructed.
When he ended the call, he said, okay, what was that all about?
It's part of the story.
Let's hear it.
Throughout the narrative, Myers at times showed remorse and at times seemed indifferent to the tragedy.
What a mistake,
he mumbled more than once as Lacey described taking the bait from the informant.
Was there an autopsy?
He asked. As far as Lacey knew, an autopsy had never been mentioned. No. Why would they do an autopsy?
I don't know. Just curious.
Lacey closed her eyes and began tapping her forehead as if in a trance.
What is it?
Myers asked. He had a light. A light on his head, like a miner or something.
A headlamp.
I guess. I can see it now. He looked at me through my window, which was shattered.
Did you see his face?
No. The light was too bright. She covered her face with both hands and gently massaged her forehead with her fingertips. A minute passed, then another. Gently, Myers asked,
did you see the other guy?
She shook her head. No. It's gone now. I know there were two of them. Two figures moving around. One with the headlamp thing, and I think the other had a regular flashlight. I heard their footsteps as they stepped on the broken glass.
Did they say anything?
Nothing I remember. I was stunned.
Sure you were, Lacey. You had a concussion. That'll screw up your memory.
She smiled, stood, walked to the fridge, and took out some orange juice. Myers said,
what kinds of cell phones?
Older BlackBerry models, issued by BJC. She poured two glasses and set them on the table. I have an iPhone, but I left it here. Hugo used the state phone for everything. I'm not sure he had another. Our IT guy says it's impossible to hack into the state phones.
But it can be done. For the right money, they can hire the hackers.
Our guy says not to worry. He's also tried to track the phones, but there's no signal, which means they're probably at the bottom of the ocean.
I worry about everything. That's why I'm still alive.
Lacey walked to a tall kitchen window and looked at the clouds. With her back to Myers, she posed the question. So, tell me, Greg, what did they gain by killing Hugo? Myers stood and stretched his legs. He took a sip of orange juice and said,
intimidation. Somehow they got wind you guys were snooping around, so they reacted. As far as the police are concerned, it looks like an accident. But taking the cell phones also sent the message to you and BJC.
Could I be next?
I doubt it. They had you on the ropes and could have easily finished you off. One dead guy is warning enough. If something happened to you now, it would bring the full weight of the federal government.
And what about you?
Oh, I'll never be safe. Their first objective will be to find Greg Myers, whoever the hell he is, and take him, me, out, quietly. But they'll never find me.
Can they find the mole?
No, I don't think so.
A lot of uncertainties, Greg.
He walked to the window and stood beside her. The rain had started and drops were hitting the glass.
You want to quit?
He asked.
I can withdraw the complaint and get on with life. Same for you. You've shed enough blood. Life is too short.
I can't do that, Greg. Not now. If we walk away, the bad guys win again. Hugo died for nothing. BJC would be a joke. No. I'm still in.
And what's the end game?
The corruption is exposed. McDover and Dubose and company are indicted and prosecuted. The mole gets his rewards. Hugo's death is investigated and those responsible are brought to justice. Junior Mace walks after 15 years on death row. And whoever killed Sun Rusko and Eileen Mace is put on trial.
Anything else?
No. That should keep me busy for the next month or so.
You can't do it by yourself, Lacey. You need a lot of help.
Yes, I do. And that's where the FBI comes in. They have the resources and expertise. We don't. If you want this case cracked and the bad guys rounded up, then you have to ease up on the FBI.
You're assuming they will investigate.
Yes.
And that might be assuming too much. When do you approach them?
It's unlikely the FBI will get involved if we're not involved first. As you know, the agency has shown an extreme reluctance to stick its nose into Indian matters. So, our plans are to serve your complaint on McDover. She'll have 30 days to respond. We'll take it one step at a time.
You must protect my identity at all times, Lacey. If you can't promise that, then I'm checking out now. And I'm not working directly with the FBI. You can, and I'll feed you everything we get from the mole, but I will have no contact with the FBI. Understood?
Understood.
And you be careful, Lacey. These are dangerous people, and they're desperate.
I get it, Greg. They killed Hugo, didn't they?
They did, and I'm sorry. I wish I'd never called you.
Too late for that. He pulled a thin burner from his pocket and handed it over.
Use this for the next month. I have one, too.
She held it in the palm of her hand as if it were stolen, then finally nodded and said, Okay, I guess.
In 30 days... I'll send you another one. Keep it close at all times. If the wrong people get it, I'm a dead man. And I wouldn't like your chances either.
She watched him drive away in a rented car with Ohio plates and gripped his cheap phone while wondering how in the world she had gotten herself into such a mess. During her first 9 years at BJC, her most interesting case had been a Duval County Circuit Court judge who preyed on attractive women going through bad divorces on his docket. He'd also preyed on court reporters, clerks, and secretaries. Any female, really, who had a nice figure and was unlucky enough to get near his courtroom. Lacey forced him to resign, and he later went to jail. But nothing like this. The inevitable moment had arrived, and Lacey was not ready for it. Nor would she ever be. Thus, she had no choice. Simon, her neighbor, agreed to ride along and talk her through it. Tentatively, she approached the small Ford rental, a loaner provided by her insurance policy and delivered the day before.
She opened the door and slowly eased herself behind the wheel. She gripped it hard and felt her pulse hammering through her hands. Simon got in, put on his seatbelt, and suggested that she do the same. She inserted the key, started the engine, and sat paralyzed as the air conditioning slowly came to life. "Take a deep breath," he said. "This is going to be easy."
"There's nothing easy about it."
She gently pulled the gear shift into reverse and released the brake. When the car actually moved, she felt a wave of dizziness and hit the brake again. "Come on, Lacey, let's get this over with," he said, a Brit with one of those stiff upper lips. "You have no choice."
I know.
She released the brake again and inched backward. She turned and left the space free, then stopped and moved the gear shift into drive. No other car was moving in the small lot next to her building, but she feared them anyway. Too cheerily, Simon said, "Now, Lacey, one must take pressure off the brake for the vehicle to move forward."
I know,
she repeated, almost mumbling. The car began to ease forward, then turned and stopped at the street, which was lightly traveled on a busy day. "Take a right here," he said. "I see nothing coming."
"My hands are sweaty," she said.
"So are mine. It's hot as hell in here. Now, move along, Lacey. You're doing fine. All is well." She turned onto the street and pressed the accelerator. It was impossible to ignore the memories of her last drive, but she tried her best. Mumbling helped, and she kept saying,
This is working.
"You're great, Lacey. A bit more speed, if you will." She glanced at the speedometer as it topped 20, then began to slow for a stop sign. She made the block, then another. 15 minutes later, she was back at the apartment, dry-mouthed and drenched with sweat. "Shall we do it again?" Simon asked.
"Give me an hour," she said. "I need to lie down."
"As you wish, dear. Just give me a ring."
Chapter 21 None of the three had ever visited the town of Stirling. Population 3,500. And after a quick loop around the hideous courthouse, they were certain they would not want to drop in again. Michael parked his SUV near a war memorial, and the three got out. Certain they were being watched, they walked purposefully along the front sidewalk and through the main door. For this somber occasion, Michael and Justin wore dark suits, as if they were entering the courthouse for a major trial. Justin was just along for the ride, and to provide some muscle and give the impression that BJC had the manpower and meant business. Lacey wore black slacks and flat shoes. She could walk without a limp, but her left knee was still swollen. She also wore a beige blouse and a silk Hermes scarf on her head. She had debated whether to walk into the meeting with no hat, no scarf, nothing to hide her shaved scalp and jagged cut with the suture indentation still fresh. On the one hand, she wanted Claudia McDover to see the damage, to be forced to stare at a living, breathing casualty of her corruption. But on the other hand, Lacey's vanity said cover it up. They climbed the stairs to the third floor and found the office of the Honorable Claudia F. McDover, Circuit Court Judge, 24th Judicial District. Inside, a receptionist greeted them without a smile. Michael said, "I'm Mr. Geismar, and I believe I spoke with you on the phone. We have an appointment with the judge at 5 p.m.
"I'll tell her."
5 o'clock came and went. At 5:15, the receptionist opened the door and said, "Judge McDover." They walked into her office, and she greeted them with a smile that was plainly forced. Lacey avoided shaking her hand.
In a corner of the large room, two men rose from a conference table and introduced themselves as Judge McDover's lawyers. Their presence was not a surprise. Michael had called the day before to arrange the meeting. Thus, Judge McDover had 24 hours to begin lawyering up. The older guy was Edgar Killebrew, an infamous white-collar defense lawyer from Pensacola. He was tall and thick and sharply dressed in navy pinstripes, and his thinning gray hair was slicked back and fell beneath his collar. By reputation, he was loud and flamboyant, and intimidating because he was always ready for a fight and seldom lost before juries. His associate was Ian Archer, an unsmiling sort who refused to shake hands with anyone and reeked of surliness. Awkwardly, they settled around the conference table. Judge McDover sat on one side with a lawyer at each elbow. Michael faced her, with Lacey and Justin at his sides. Small talk was useless. Who cared about the weather? Michael began. A formal complaint was filed against Judge McDover 45 days ago. We've done the assessment, and as you know, our initial threshold is not very high. If it appears that the complaint may have merit, then we pass it along to the judge. That's why we're here today. We understand this, Killebrew said sharply.
Lacey stared at McDover and wondered if it was all true. The years of payoffs in return for favorable decisions. The outright stealing from the Tapacola. The murder of Hugo Hatch. The private jets and unlimited cash and homes around the world. The wrongful conviction of Junior Mace. No. Actually, at that moment, it did not seem possible that this attractive woman, an elected judge from a small town, could be involved in such ugly and far-reaching crimes. And what did McDover see when she looked at Lacey? The scarf hiding the wounds? A lucky girl who could have died? A nuisance to be dealt with later? A threat? Whatever the judge was thinking, she revealed nothing. Her face was all business, as unpleasant as it was. The beauty of Lacey's strategy was that at that moment, McDover had no idea what the mole had already told them. No idea they had an inkling of the cash, jets, homes, all the goodies. She was about to realize that her four condos had raised suspicions. But that was all.
Could we see the complaint? Killebrew asked. Michael slid across the original and three copies. McDover, Killebrew, and Archer grabbed them and began reading. But they were careful not to react. If the judge was shocked, she hid her surprise well. Nothing. No anger, no disbelief. Nothing but a cool, dispassionate reading of accusations. Her lawyers read the complaint and managed to convey a smug indifference. Archer made a few notes on a legal pad. The minutes ticked by. The tension was thick, palpable. Finally, McDover said, without a trace of emotion, "This is absurd."
"Who is Greg Myers?" Killebrew said coolly.
"We're not going to reveal his identity at this time," Michael replied.
"Well, we'll find out, won't we? I mean, this is defamatory as hell, and we'll sue him immediately for a ton of cash. He can't hide."
Michael shrugged and said, "Sue who you gotta sue. That's none of our business." Archer asked, with an obnoxious nasal tone that indicated he was far more intelligent than anyone else in the room,
"During the assessment, what did you learn that indicated these allegations have merit?"
"We're not required to divulge that at this time. As I'm sure you know, from a careful review of the statutes, Judge McDover has 30 days to respond in writing. During that period, we will continue to investigate. Once we receive your response, we will respond to it."
"I got a response for you right now,"
Killebrew growled. This is defamatory, libelous, and a complete crock of shit. It's all lies. The Board on Judicial Conduct should be investigated for taking this rubbish seriously and defiling the name of one of the highest-rated judges in the state of Florida.
You gonna sue us, too?
Lacey asked coolly and knocked him off stride. Killebrew glared at her but did not take the bait.
I'm concerned about confidentiality, Judge McDover said. I'm not worried about these allegations because they are groundless and will prove that in short order. But I have a reputation to protect. This is the first complaint filed against me after 17 years on the bench.
Which proves nothing, Lacey said, itching for a little skirmish.
Correct, Ms. Stultz, but I want assurances that this matter will be kept quiet.
Michael replied. We are quite aware of the need for secrecy, that we are dealing with reputations, and for this we closely follow the statute that makes our investigations confidential. But you'll be talking to potential witnesses, Killebrew said, and word gets around. I know how these investigations go. They can become witch hunts where the gossip flies and people get hurt.
People have already been hurt. Lacey said, as she glared, unblinking, at Judge McDover, who returned the stare as if she could not have cared less. For a moment there was no air to breathe.
Michael finally moved on with, We handle these investigations every day, Mr. Killebrew. I assure you we know how to keep things quiet. Oftentimes, though, the chatter seems to come from the other side.
Nice try, sir. But there will be no chatter from us, Killebrew said. We'll file a motion to dismiss as soon as practical and get this crap thrown out.
Michael replied. I've been with the BJC for almost 30 years, and I have yet to see a case in which the board dismissed the complaint before the responses were filed. But go ahead and try.
That's great, Mr. Geismar. And in your years of vast experience, how often do you serve complaints in which the identity of the complaining party is not revealed?
His name is Greg Myers. Right there on the front page.
Thank you. But who is Mr. Greg Myers? And where does he live? There is no address, no contact information, nothing.
It would be inappropriate for you to contact Mr. Myers.
I didn't say I wanted to contact him. We just want to know who he is and why he is accusing my client of something that amounts to bribery. That's all.
To be discussed later, Michael said.
Anything else? McDover asked. The judge was in charge and ready to adjourn.
No, not from us, Michael replied. We will await your response in 30 days, if not sooner.
Without a handshake and with hardly a nod, they stood and left the room. Nothing was said as they walked to the car and drove away. As the town faded behind them, Michael finally said,
Okay, let's hear it.
Justin spoke first.
The fact that she hired the most expensive lawyer around here before she knew what was coming raises suspicions. Would she hire him if she wasn't guilty of something? And how can she afford him on a judge's salary? Narco-traffickers and other big-time crooks have the cash for a guy like Killebrew, but not a circuit court judge.
I guess she's got the cash, Lacey said.
Michael said, As cool as she was, I saw fear. And not the fear of a soiled reputation. That's the least of her worries. You agree, Lacey? Could you read her?
I didn't get the impression she's afraid.
She's too cold-blooded for that.
Justin said,
Look, we know what she's going to do. She'll file a thick response in which she claims she purchased the condos years ago as investments. It's not against the law to do so with offshore companies. It may look suspicious, but it's not illegal or even unethical.
Lacey said,
Okay, but how can she prove she paid for them?
Michael ventured a guess.
She'll find some records. She has Von Dubose somewhere in the dark cooking the books, and now she has Edgar Killebrew blowing smoke. This will not be easy.
We've known that from the beginning, Lacey said.
We need more from Myers, Michael said. We need the smoking gun.
Yes, we do, and Myers needs to lay as low as possible, Justin added. You saw how eager they are to find him.
They're not going to find Myers, Lacey said with authority, as if she knew more than her colleagues. They had driven 2 hours for a 15-minute meeting, but that was the nature of their work. If there was time, Lacey wanted to at least see her wrecked car and check for forgotten odds and ends in its console and trunk. Michael had tried to persuade her otherwise. Whatever she left behind, old CDs, an umbrella, a few coins, would not be worth the horror of seeing the evidence of Hugo's fatal injuries.
But, since they were in the neighborhood and had a few minutes, Michael wanted to say hello to Constable Gritt and introduce him to Lacey. Gritt had been on the scene and had helped with her rescue, and Lacey wanted to at least say thanks. It was almost 6 p.m. when they arrived at the police station near the casino. A cop was loitering around the front desk, and when Michael asked for Constable Gritt, he was informed that he no longer worked there. There was a new constable, and he'd gone home for the day.
What happened to Gritt? Michael asked, immediately suspicious.
The cop shrugged as if he had no idea.
You can ask the chief, but I doubt if you'll get an answer.
They drove 2 blocks to the salvage yard, and through a locked chain-link gate looked at a dozen old wrecks. The sad collection did not include Lacey's Prius or the Dodge Ram that collided with it. They were gone.
Oh, boy,
Michael mumbled.
Gritt assured me the vehicles would be secured. I told him there might be an investigation. I thought we were on the same page.
How long was he the constable? Lacey asked.
I think he said 4 years.
I guess we need to talk to him.
We're going to be very careful. Right, Lacey?
Chapter 22 The new constable was Billy Cappell, the chief's son and a council member. When the chief announced Billy's appointment, he explained to the police force that it was only temporary. Billy would serve until a proper search could be completed and the right man hired for the job. Since the new guy would no doubt come from the tribe, a proper search wouldn't take long. Indeed, both the chief and Billy knew that the interim position would soon evolve into a more permanent one. Billy earned $50,000 a year as a council member, in addition to his monthly dividends. As constable, his new salary was 3 times that. Plus, thanks to a new rule, he could play head cop and stay on the council. It was a good deal, especially for the Cappell clan. Billy's law enforcement resume was rather thin, but then he really didn't need one. He had worked for a short time in casino security before being elected, and he had volunteered for the rescue squad before it had been upgraded with full-time personnel. During the second day of his new job, the police in Foley called with some interest in arresting Burl Munger, the man in the video who helped steal the Dodge Ram. Since the Foley police could not cross the state line to make the arrest, and since the Tapakola police had no jurisdiction off their reservation, the situation was a bit complicated. Billy promised to contact the police in Dufuniak Springs and enlist their help. He did no such thing. Rather, he called his father, who passed along the word. Burl Munger soon knew there was an Alabama warrant for his arrest. Billy couldn't find the video the Foley police were talking about. He searched the police offices, all its files and computers, and found nothing.
He suspected that Lyman Gritt had somehow hidden the video or taken it with him. He called his father again and said they might have a problem. He called Foley and asked for the video, but the police there were already skeptical and asking themselves what the hell those Indians were doing over there. They said they would send the video, but were in no hurry to do so.
Burl Munger vanished. Billy and the chief paid a visit to the home of Lyman Gritt. In a tense meeting, Gritt swore he knew nothing about a video. He had no idea what the cops in Foley were talking about. The chief offered the usual threats, but Gritt was not easily intimidated. He finally asked them to leave his property. As constable, he had found the chief meddlesome and dishonest. Now that he was unemployed, he despised the man, along with the rest of his family. The video was hidden in Gritt's attic, along with a copy of the one from Frog Freeman's store. Gritt considered himself an honest cop who had been fired by politicians who had been compromised. If the day of reckoning ever arrived, he might need some leverage. Honest, and also quite capable. 2 days after the accident, as the questions were piling up and the answers were proving elusive, Gritt had driven, alone, to the scene of the accident. He was stumped by 3 obvious puzzles. The first, why would a car thief steal a vehicle worth at least $30,000 and drive it 3 hours to a remote spot on an Indian reservation? The county road where it came to rest was in the middle of their tribal land and literally went nowhere. It began on the back side of the casino property, snaked its way deeper into the reservation, and was used by only a handful of Tapakola who lived in the boondocks. With bloated budgets, the tribe kept it paved and well-maintained, but the same was now true for almost every pig trail and field road on the land. Judging by his actions on the video, the thief had experience, and veterans like him usually sold their stolen wheels to chop shops within hours. They did not roam around strange places at midnight sipping Jack Daniels and driving recklessly. To Gritt's knowledge, there were no fencing operations in Brunswick County. He found it impossible to believe that the driver, drinking or even drunk, could survive a head-on collision, even with a small Prius, absorb the blow from the airbag, and simply walk away. And where would he go? The reservation was half swamp and uninhabitable. The higher land was covered in thick woods. The only decent land had been taken by the casino. At midnight, an intruder wandering around the depths of the reservation would get hopelessly lost in 5 minutes. If the guy with the busted nose in Frog's video was indeed the driver of the stolen truck, then he had an accomplice, one driving another truck with fake Florida plates. This was the first puzzle, and none of the pieces fit. The second one was even more confusing. What were 2 lawyers, whose jobs were to investigate judicial misconduct, doing on the reservation at midnight? They were not trespassing. Try as they might, Native Americans had so far been unable to wall off outsiders. But the two had absolutely no jurisdiction. The tribal court had 3 members, well-paid but thoroughly lacking in legal education. The Florida Board on Judicial Conduct couldn't touch them. The third puzzle was just as obvious. How did the wreck happen? There was apparently no other traffic, just the 2 vehicles on a dark, flat stretch of road. The weather was clear. There was no posted speed limit, but with the twists and turns, any driver would struggle to safely exceed 50 miles per hour. Even under the influence, the missing driver should have been able to stay in his lane. Standing at the exact point of impact and looking at the asphalt scarred with the stains of engine fluids and littered with debris, Gritt had admitted he was stumped. This was not an open and shut case of a deadly collision and a fleeing driver. There was obviously much more to it.
A dozen emergency vehicles had left a maze of tire marks on the shoulders, and even in the ditches and the flat field to the east. If the second truck, the one with the fake Florida tags, scooped up the driver, then where would it go? Perhaps it would stay off the road and avoid being seen by a Tapacola leaving the casino after the late shift. So far, Grit had spoken to every resident in the area, and no one saw anything. Most had been asleep. Only Mrs. Beale had heard the sound of the impact. In the dirt beyond a shallow roadside ditch, Grit had noticed tracks that led away from the scene. Wide tires, wide body, heavy traction, probably a pickup truck. He followed them for 50 yards. And in a thicket of cuckoo burrs found a wad of paper towels, 4 sheets crushed into a ball and held together by a dried substance that could only be blood. He didn't touch it, but returned to his patrol car and from the trunk removed a plastic Ziploc bag. Using a stick, he gently placed the paper towels in the bag, then continued following the tracks. He lost them in some brush and grass and picked them up again 1/4 mile from his car. They crossed an empty creek bed, continued on for about 100 yards, and turned left onto a gravel road he'd never seen before. At that point, the tracks were impossible to follow. The road curved back and forth for 1/2 mile, passed only 1 home in the distance, and ended at a paved road called Sandy Lane. Grit had then slowly backtracked to the accident scene and gotten his car. From Frog's video, he had a clear shot of the guy's face. Now, with some luck, he had a sample of his blood. The driver of the truck knew the area better than the constable. The meeting took place in an unfurnished condo on Seagrove Beach, one of many built and sold by another faceless entity lost in the maze of the DuBose organization. When Chief Kappel arrived in the parking lot, alone, he was escorted into the building by a man he knew only as Hank. After years of dealing with DuBose, the chief was still amazed at how little he knew about the man and those around him. He figured Hank must have some clout because he stayed in the room for the meeting, saying nothing but hearing every word. DuBose was at the end of a long day. 2 hours earlier, he had met Claudia McDover at her condo in Rabbit Run and been briefed on the meeting with BJC. He had read the complaint, asked the usual questions about who the hell Greg Myers was, and tried to calm his somewhat frantic judge. Afterward, he was driven to the condo, where he waited on the chief. Kappel carried a briefcase, and from it he pulled out a laptop and placed it on the snack bar. There were no chairs or seats in the new condo. The place still smelled of fresh paint. Kappel said, "There are 2 videos. The first is from the police in Foley, Alabama, and we finally got a copy of it this afternoon. We're almost certain they sent it over last week and Grit managed to lose it, or hide it, or whatever. It's not in the file, and there's no reference to it. Here it is." The chief tapped some keys and DuBose moved closer. They watched the video of the Dodge Ram being stolen from the parking lot in Foley. DuBose said nothing until it was over, then said, "Play it again." They watched it 2nd time. "What do you know?" DuBose asked. "The Honda pickup is owned by a man named Burl Munger, who got a call and has disappeared. What do you know about him?" DuBose backed away and paced around the den. "Nothing. It was a contract job. We needed a stolen truck, so we made a call. Munger is not part of the club, just an independent contractor. He knows nothing." "Well, he dealt with someone when he handed over the truck and took the cash. He's got something to say." "He does, yes. I'm assuming he was told to get lost and stay there." "He was.
Who was the other guy? The one who stole the Dodge Ram?
I have no idea. Someone working with Munger, I guess. Again, we don't know these people. We just paid cash for a stolen truck.
DuBose walked back to the counter and stared at the screen.
Let me see the other video.
The chief tapped some keys and Frog's video appeared. DuBose watched it and began shaking his head in disgust. He watched again and began cursing.
Dumbass, dumbass, dumbass,
he mumbled.
So you know these guys, right?
Yes.
And the kid with the busted nose was driving the Dodge Ram when it wrecked, right?
Shit, shit, shit.
I guess that means yes, yes, yes. You know, Vaughn, I really don't like all these secrets. You pull this job on our land and tell me nothing. I don't want to be your partner, but in many respects, we are joined at the hip. If there's a leak in the dike, I need to know it.
DuBose was pacing again, chewing on a nail, trying to stay cool but wanting to erupt.
What do you want to know?
He snapped.
Who is the guy with the busted nose? And how can you use people who are so blatantly stupid? They make a late-night stop at a country store, park not in the shadows but directly in front, just begging to get themselves on surveillance, and presto, we've got photos of your men just after the big job.
They are stupid, okay? Who's seen this video? The second one.
Me, you, Billy, Frog, Sheriff Pickett, and Grit.
So we can contain it, right?
Maybe. Grit worries me. He lied about the first video. Said he knew nothing about it. But the cops in Foley told Billy they sent it over a week ago. Grit's up to something. And now that he's out of a job, he's really pissed. I wouldn't be surprised if he's got copies of both videos hidden somewhere. I tried to talk to him, but it didn't go well.
What the hell is he doing?
I had to fire him, remember? You were in on that decision. We had to get rid of him so we control the investigation. The BJC is sniffing around, and they're suspicious as hell. Who knows? They might go to the feds and convince them to take a closer look. Grit was never much of a team player. He had to go.
All right, all right,
DuBose said as he looked through a sliding door and gazed into the darkness.
Here's what we do. You arrange a meeting with Grit and convince him he's playing with fire. He's wandering off the reservation, so rein him in.
I really don't like that metaphor.
DuBose turned around and walked to the chief as if he might throw a punch. His eyes were glowing, his temper about to explode.
And I don't give a damn what you like. We're not going under because Grit got his feelings hurt over losing a job. Explain to him who you're dealing with. He's got a wife and three kids, and his life is pretty good, even without his cute little constable's uniform. There's too much at stake for him to find religion at this point. He shuts his mouth, turns over whatever he's hiding, and gets in line. Or else. Got it?
I'm not going to hurt a brother.
You won't have to. You don't understand intimidation, Chief. I wrote the book. It's all I've ever known. It's what I enjoy. And Grit needs to understand this. If I go under, then so do you, and so do a lot of other people. But it's not going to happen. Your job is to convince Grit to shut up and get in line. Do that, and everything will be just fine.
The chief reached over and closed his laptop.
What about Sheriff Pickett?
He asked. He has no jurisdiction over the accident. You do. It's one less wreck for him to worry about. Besides, I can take care of the sheriff. Get Grit in line. Make sure Munger is gone. Stall the boys over in Foley.
and we'll weather this little storm just fine. And the guy with the busted nose? He'll be 1,000 miles away by noon tomorrow. Let me deal with him.
Chapter 23 Lacey was back in the office full time, and while her presence raised spirits somewhat, Hugo's absence was still a gaping hole. She and Geismar kept most of the details to themselves, but there was now an accepted belief that his death was more than a tragic accident. For a tiny agency, the mysterious death of one of its own was unsettling. No one at BJC had ever considered their jobs dangerous. Though her movements were slow and her head was still covered with a growing collection of scarves, albeit fashionable ones, Lacey was a delight to be around and an inspiration to her colleagues. She was regaining her strength and working longer hours. 2 days after serving the complaint on Claudia McDover, Lacey was at her desk when she received a call from Edgar Killebrew. Pompous, even on the phone, he began with a pleasant,
"You know, Ms. Stoltz, the more I study this complaint, the more I find it appalling. It's groundless, and I'm stunned that Conduct would even remotely consider pursuing it."
"You've already said that," Lacey replied calmly. "Any objections to my recording this conversation?"
"I don't give a damn what you do."
Lacey pressed the record button on her phone and asked, "Now, what can I do for you?"
"You can dismiss this damned complaint. That's what you can do. And you can tell Mr. Greg Myers that I'll keep his ass tied up in court for the next 10 years fighting libel suits."
"I'll pass that along. And I'm sure Mr. Myers understands that there is nothing libelous or defamatory in his complaint, because it has not been made public."
"We'll see about that. I've decided not to file a motion to dismiss, simply because it will only draw attention to this matter. The board has 5 members, 5 political hacks who sucked up to the governor, and I don't trust any of them when it comes to keeping secrets, just like I don't trust anybody in your office. This has got to be kept as quiet as possible. Do you understand, Ms. Stoltz?"
"We had this conversation in Judge McDover's office 2 days ago.
"Well, we're having it again. And furthermore, I'd like to know more about your investigation. Doubtless it's going nowhere, so I'm afraid you'll get desperate and start cold-calling anybody who might possibly know my client. That's how rumors get started. Vicious rumors, Ms. Stoltz. And, well, I just don't trust you or anyone else to handle this matter with discretion."
"You're worrying too much, Mr. Killebrew. We do this every day, and we understand confidentiality. And I'm not at liberty to discuss our investigation."
"Well, I'm warning you that if this case becomes a witch hunt and my client's reputation is damaged, I'll sue you and Mr. Geismar and everybody else at Conduct for defamation."
"Go ahead. And we'll countersue for filing a frivolous lawsuit."
"Beautiful. Just beautiful. I would relish the opportunity of seeing you guys in court. I live there, Ms. Stoltz, and you do not."
"Anything else, Mr. Killebrew?"
"Nothing. Good day."
As cool as she sounded on the phone, the call was nonetheless unsettling. Killebrew was a fearless litigator, infamous for his scorched-earth tactics. Such a lawsuit would ultimately be deemed frivolous, but the prospect of wrangling with him was intimidating. And he was right. He earned big money in front of juries, and Lacey had never seen one. She played the call for Michael, who managed to laugh. He had received such threats before. She had not. As long as BJC did its job and did not step out of bounds, the agency was basically immune from civil lawsuits. Otherwise, they would never serve a complaint. She returned to her desk and tried to concentrate on other matters. For the second time, she called the constable's office and asked for Billy Kappel. He was too busy at the moment.
She called back an hour later, and he was still in a meeting. She called her insurance company and eventually tracked down the adjuster who had her totaled Prius. He informed